History's Book 3, Thalia. It was against this Amasis that Cambyses, son of Cyrus, marched, bringing with him the other peoples he ruled, including the Ionian and Aeolian Greeks, for the following reason. Cambyses sent a herald to Egypt asking Amasis for his daughter, and he did this on the advice of an Egyptian man who bore a grudge against Amasis, because Amasis had taken him away from his wife and children and sent him off to the Persians when Cyrus had sent to Amasis asking for the best eye doctor in Egypt. It was this grievance that drove the Egyptian to give his advice, urging Cambyses to ask Amasis for his daughter, so that either Amasis would give her and be grieved, or refuse and become hateful to Cambyses. Amasis, distressed and afraid of the power of the Persians, could neither give her nor refuse her, for he knew perfectly well that Cambyses did not intend to make her his wife, but rather his concubine. Turning this over, he did the following. Apries, the former king, had a daughter, quite tall and lovely, the sole survivor of that household, and her name was Nyctes. Amasis dressed this girl in fine clothing and gold and sent her off to the Persians as though she were his own daughter. Some time later, when Cambyses greeted her by her patronymic, the girl told him, "King, you have been tricked by Amasis, though you do not know it. He dressed me up and sent me to you claiming I was his own daughter, but Apries was truly my father, and that man, who had been Apries' own master, murdered him by rising up against him with the help of the Egyptians." These words, and this grievance, arose and led Cambyses, son of Cyrus, greatly enraged, against Egypt. This is how the Persians tell it. The Egyptians, however, claim Cambyses as their own, saying that he was born from this same daughter of Apries, for they say it was Cyrus who sent to Amasis for the daughter, not Cambyses. But in saying this, they are not speaking correctly. Nor are they unaware, for if any others know the customs of the Persians, so do the Egyptians, that in the first place it is not their custom for a bastard son to become king when a legitimate one is present, and further, that Cambyses was the son of Cassandane, daughter of Pharnaspes, and Achaemenid, not of the Egyptian woman. But they twist the story, wishing to claim kinship with the house of Cyrus. So much for that. There is also another story told, does not strike me as convincing, that one of the Persian women, coming in among Cyrus's wives, noticed the tall, handsome children standing next to Cassandane and lavished praise on them in wonder, and Cassandane, who was Cyrus's wife, answered, "Even though I am the mother of children like these, Cyrus keeps me in disgrace, while he prizes the woman he brought back from Egypt." So she said this out of resentment toward Nyctes, and her eldest son, Cambyses, replied, "Then, mother, once I am grown, I will turn Egypt upside down." He said this at about 10 years old, and the women marveled at it, and remembering it, once he reached manhood and took the kingship, made the campaign against Egypt. Another thing also happened, contributing to this expedition. Among the mercenaries of Amasis was a man of Halicarnassian birth named Phanes, sound in judgment and valiant in war. This Phanes, bearing some grievance against Amasis, fled from Egypt by ship, wishing to go and speak with Cambyses. Because he held no small standing among the mercenaries and knew the affairs of Egypt with great precision, Amasis went after him eagerly, wanting to seize him, and dispatched the most trusted of his eunuchs after him in a trireme, who overtook him in Lycia. But though he caught him, he could not manage to return him to Egypt, for Phanes outwitted him. He got the guards drunk and slipped away to Persia. As Cambyses was preparing his campaign against Egypt and puzzling over how to cross the waterless stretch, Phanes came forward and revealed not only Amasis's other affairs, but also laid out the route, urging him to send word to the Arabian king asking that he be granted safe passage across his territory. This is the sole place where routes into Egypt lie open. From Phoenicia as far as the city of Catades lies on the border and belongs to the Syrians called Palestinian. From Catades, a city, as I judge it, not much smaller than Sardis, the trading posts along the coast up to the city of Enesis belong to the Arabian, and from Enesis onward, they belong again to the Syrians as far as Lake Cerberus, beside which Mount Cassius runs down to the sea. And from Lake Cerberus, where it is said Typhon lies hidden, from there onward is Egypt. Now the region between the city of Enesis and Mount Cassius and Lake Cerberus, which is no small stretch of land but about a 3 days' journey, is terribly waterless. I will now tell something that few of those who sail to Egypt have noticed. Into Egypt from all of Greece and also from Phoenicia, jars full of wine are brought in twice each year, and there is not a single empty wine jar to be seen anywhere, so to speak. Where then, one might ask, do these go? I will explain this too. Each district officer must gather up all the jars from his own city and carry them to Memphis, and those from Memphis must fill them with water and carry them to those waterless parts of Syria. So the jars that arrive and are unloaded in Egypt are carried on to the old ones already in Syria. This, then, is how the Persians prepared this entry into Egypt, packing it with water according to what has been said, as soon as they had taken Egypt. But at that time, since there was no water ready yet, Cambyses, having learned of it from his Halicarnassian guest friend, sent word to the Arabian and, requesting safe conduct, secured it, exchanging pledges with him. The Arabians honor pledges between men as much as any people, and they form them in this manner. When men wish to seal such a pledge, a third party stands between them and cuts, with a sharp stone, the palms near the base of the fingers of those exchanging the pledge, and then, taking a tuft of wool from each man's cloak, smears it with the blood on seven stones set between them. And while doing this, he invokes Dionysus and Urania. Once he has finished, whoever made the pledge entrusts the guest, or the fellow citizen, if the pledge is made with one, to his own friends, and the friends too consider themselves bound to honor the pledges. They regard Dionysus and Urania as the only gods there are, and they say that the cut of their hair is like the cut of Dionysus's own hair. They cut it round, shaving off the hair at the temples. They call Dionysus Orotalt and Urania Alalat. So when the Arabian had made the pledge with the messengers sent by Cambyses, reached the Arabian, he worked out this scheme. He loaded skins full of water onto every one of his living camels, and having done so, drove them into the waterless land, where he waited there for Cambyses's army to arrive. This is the more believable of the two accounts, but since the less believable one is also told, it must be given too. In Arabia there flows a great river called the Khoris, which empties into the sea called the Red Sea. From this river, it is said, the king of the Arabians sewed together a pipe of ox hides and other hides reaching in length all the way to the waterless land, and through this brought the water, and in the waterless land, dug great cisterns to receive and preserve the water. The journey is 12 days' journey from the river to this waterless stretch. The water, it is said, was carried through three channels to three separate places. At the mouth of the Nile called Pelusion, Samanidus, son of Amasis, lay encamped, waiting for Cambyses to arrive. Cambyses had not found Amasis still alive when he marched on Egypt. Amasis had ruled 44 years and then died, and in all that time nothing great misfortune had befallen him, and having died and been embalmed, he was buried in the tomb in the temple which he himself had built. During the reign of Samanidus, son of Amasis, over Egypt, the greatest portent yet occurred for the Egyptians. For it rained upon Thebes in Egypt, a thing that had never happened before nor has happened since, down to my own time, as the Thebans themselves say, for it never rains at all in the upper part of Egypt. But even then Thebes was rained upon, with a light drizzle. When the Persians, having crossed the waterless land, encamped near the Egyptians so as to give battle, then the mercenaries of the Egyptian, being Greeks and Carians, angry with Phanes for having led a foreign army against Egypt, devised the following against him. Phanes had children left behind in Egypt, left behind. These the mercenaries led into the camp, and before their father's eyes set a mixing bowl between the two armies, then brought the children forward one at a time and cut their throats over it. Once they had gone through all the children, they poured in wine and water, and every one of the mercenaries drank of the blood before at last joining battle. The fighting grew fierce, and once many men had fallen on both sides, the Egyptians broke and fled. There I witnessed something remarkable, which I learned about by questioning the local inhabitants. The bones of the men killed in that battle lay scattered on the field in two distinct groups, kept apart from each other. The Persian bones lay on one side, just as they had been separated right after the fight, and the Egyptian bones lay on the other. And if you look at the Persian skulls, they are so weak that if you want to strike with just a single pebble, you would pierce right through, whereas the Egyptian skulls are so strong that you would struggle to crack them even by hitting them with a stone. This was the reason they gave, and readily persuaded me too, that the Egyptians, beginning right from childhood, shave their heads and the bone thickens in the sun. This same thing is also the reason they do not go bald. You would see very few Egyptians bald, fewer than any other people. This, then, is the reason they carry such strong skulls, and for the Persians, the reason they carry weak skulls is this. From the start, they have been raised in the shade, wearing felt caps as tiaras. So much for that. I also saw other things like these at Papremis, among the men of Achaemen, son of Darius, who had been destroyed by Inaros the Libyan. When the Egyptians were routed from the battle, they fled in no order. And when they had been penned up in Memphis, Cambyses sent a Mytilenean ship up the river carrying a herald, a Persian man, to invite the Egyptians to come to terms. But when they saw the ship entering Memphis, they poured out together from the wall, destroyed the ship, and tore the men apart limb from limb like butchered meat and carried them into the wall. After this, the Egyptians under siege in time surrendered, while the neighboring Libyans, frightened by what had happened concerning Egypt, gave themselves up without a fight, imposed tribute on themselves, and sent gifts. In the same way, the Cyrenians and Barcaeans, frightened just as the Libyans were, did likewise. Cambyses received the gifts that came from the Libyans graciously, but he found fault with those that came from the Cyrenians, because, it seems to me, they were meager. For the Cyrenians had sent 500 minas of silver, and this Cambyses grabbed with his own hand and scattered among his army. On the 10th day after he took the wall at Memphis, Cambyses set up the king of the Egyptians, Samonidus, who had reigned 6 months, in the suburb for public humiliation, seating him there together with other Egyptians, and tested his spirit by doing the following. He dressed the king's daughter in a slave's clothing and sent her out for water, carrying a water jar, and sent with her other maidens chosen from the leading men, dressed in the same manner as the king's daughter. When the maidens passed, crying out and weeping, before their fathers, all the other fathers cried out and cried out likewise on seeing their own children abused, yet Samonidus, who had already noticed and understood what was coming, only lowered his eyes to the ground. Once the water carriers had gone past, Cambyses next sent the king's son forward, along with 2,000 other Egyptian youths of the same age, all with ropes tied around their necks and bits fastened in their mouths. They were being marched off to answer for the Mytilenean crew who had died at Memphis together with their vessel. This was because the royal judges had ruled that 10 leading Egyptians must die for every one of those men. Samonidus, watching them go by and realizing his own son was being marched toward death, while the other Egyptians seated around him wailed and carried on in horror, reacted just as he had when he saw his daughter. Once this group too had gone past, it so happened that one of his old drinking companions, a man well past his prime, who had lost everything he owned and had nothing left except what a beggar has, and was begging from the soldiers, came past Samonidus son of Amasis and the Egyptians sitting in the suburb. When Samonidus saw him, he cried out loudly, called his companion by name, and struck himself on the head. Now he had guards stationed there, who reported everything he did on each occasion of these processions to Cambyses. Marveling at what he was doing, Cambyses sent a messenger and questioned him, saying this, "Your master Cambyses asks you, Samonidus, why, seeing your daughter mistreated and your son marching to his death, you neither cried out nor wept, and yet you honored the beggar, who, as he learns from others, is nothing to you." So he asked these things, and the other answered as follows. "O son of Cyrus, my own household's misfortunes were too great for weeping, but my companion's grief deserved tears, a man who, fallen from great wealth and prosperity, has come to beggary on the very threshold of old age." When this was reported back, it seemed to Cambyses and his men that it had been well said. And as the Egyptians tell it, Croesus wept, for he too happened to be present, having accompanied Cambyses' expedition into Egypt, and the Persians standing nearby wept along with him. Cambyses himself felt a pang of pity, and at once gave orders that the boy be spared from among the condemned, and that Samonidus be brought in from the outlying district and led into his presence. Yet when the men sent to fetch the son arrived, they discovered he had already died, having been the very first one cut down. Samonidus, however, they did bring forward and lead before Cambyses, and it was there from then on he lived, treated with no violence. And if he had also known how not to meddle further, he would have gotten Egypt back to govern as its overseer, since the Persians are accustomed to honor the sons of kings. Even when their fathers revolt against them, they still restore the rule to the sons. There is much evidence one could draw on elsewhere to show that this is indeed their established custom, and among it also the case of Thanyras, son of Aneros, who got back the rule his father had held, and that of Posiris, son of Amyatius, for he too got back his father's rule, and yet none had done the Persians more harm than Aneros and Amyatius. But as it turned out, Samonidus, scheming further evil, got his due reward, for he was caught inciting the Egyptians to revolt, and when Cambyses found this out, Samonidus drank bull's blood and died on the spot. So this man met his end. Cambyses went on from Memphis to the city of Sais, intending to do what in fact he did. For when he entered the house of Amasis, he immediately ordered Amasis's corpse carried out of its tomb. And when this had been done, he ordered it whipped, and its hair plucked out and pierced with goads, and mistreating it in every remaining way. But once they tired of this treatment, since the corpse, being embalmed, resisted and would not break apart, Cambyses commanded that it be burned instead, an order that violated sacred custom, for the Persians regard fire as divine. Burning the dead is a practice neither people accepts as lawful, not the Persians, for the reason already given, since in their view it is wrong to feed a god any share of a dead man, nor of the Egyptians, who hold it as their belief that fire is a living creature, that it devours everything it seizes, and that once it is glutted with its food, it dies along with what it has eaten. Now it is by no means their custom, either, to give a corpse to wild animals, and it is for this reason that they embalm it, so that it will not lie there and be eaten by worms. Thus Cambyses ordered done what ran contrary to the customs of both peoples. However, as the Egyptians say, it was not Amasis who suffered this, but some other Egyptian of the same age as Amasis, whom the Persians, in abusing him, thought they were abusing Amasis. For they say that Amasis, having learned from an oracle what was going to happen to him after his death, and so guarding in advance against what was coming, had this man, once he had died from the whipping, buried at the doorway, inside his own tomb, and instructed his son to place his own body as far as possible in the innermost recess of the tomb. Now these instructions of Amasis, concerning the burial and the substitute man, do not seem to me to have happened at all as claimed. I think the Egyptians simply dress them up with this air of solemnity. After this, Cambyses planned 3 expeditions, against the Carthaginians, and toward the Ammonians, and toward the long-lived Ethiopians, who dwell along Libya's southern shore. Once he had weighed his options, he settled on sending his fleet against Carthage, splitting off part of his infantry to strike the Ammonians, and dispatching scouts ahead of the main force toward the Ethiopians, to find out whether the fabled sun table said to exist among that people was in fact real, and, beyond that, to look over everything else there, while pretending the purpose was to deliver gifts to their ruler. As for the table of the sun, the story goes something like this. In the outskirts there lies a meadow heaped with boiled meat from every kind of four-legged animal, and by custom the city magistrates then in office lay the meat out there each night, while by day anyone who wants to may approach and eat his fill. The locals claim that the earth itself produces this each time. Such, then, is what is said of the so-called table of the sun. When Cambyses decided to send the spies, he immediately sent for men from the city of Elephantine, from among the fish-eaters, who knew the Ethiopian language. While these were being fetched, in the meantime he ordered the naval force to sail against Carthage. But the Phoenicians said they would refuse to comply. They were held by weighty oaths, and it would be wrong of them to march against their own offspring. With the Phoenicians unwilling, the remaining ships were not strong enough to fight alone. In this way, the Carthaginians avoided falling under Persian rule. Cambyses judged it unjust to compel the Phoenicians by force, since they had submitted to Persia willingly, and the entire fleet relied on Phoenician ships. The Cypriots, too, had given themselves over to the Persians and joined the campaign against Egypt. When the fish-eaters arrived from Elephantine before Cambyses, he sent them to the Ethiopians, instructing them what they were to say and having them carry gifts: a purple robe, a twisted gold necklace, bracelets, an alabaster jar of myrrh, and a jar of palm wine. These Ethiopians, to whom sent by Cambyses are reputed to be the tallest and handsomest people anywhere. Their customs, in various respects, set them apart from other nations, and this is especially true of how they choose a king. Whichever citizen they judge tallest and strongest in proportion to his height, that man they deem worthy to rule. So it was among these very people that the fish eaters arrived, handing over the gifts. They said the following to their king: "The Persian king Cambyses, wishing to become your friend and guest friend, sent us to come and speak with you, and gives you these gifts, which he himself takes the greatest pleasure in using." The Ethiopian, realizing that they had come as spies, said the following to them: "The Persian king did not send you who bring gifts because he prizes so highly the chance to make me his friend. Neither are you telling the truth, since you have really come to spy on my kingdom, nor is that man honest. Had he been honest, he would never have craved territory beyond his own, nor would he drag off into bondage people who had wronged him not at all. Now hand him this bow and deliver this message: The king of the Ethiopians recommends to the king of the Persians that once the Persians can draw bows of this very size with such ease, only then should he march with an overwhelming force against the long-lived Ethiopians. But until that day comes, let him thank the gods for not putting into the Ethiopians' minds any wish to seize land beyond what is already theirs." After saying this and unstringing the bow, he handed it over to the visitors. Then, picking up the purple cloak, asked what it was and how it was produced. Once the fish eaters explained truthfully how the purple dye was made, he replied that the men themselves were deceitful, and so were their garments. Next, he inquired about the twisted gold neck chain and the bracelets, and as the fish eaters described these ornaments to him, the king laughed, assuming they were fetters, said that among his own people they had stronger fetters than these. Third, he asked about the perfume, and when they told him about its making and its use, he gave the same answer he had given about the cloak. When he came to the wine and learned how it was made, he was delighted with the drink and asked what the king ate and what the greatest lifespan a Persian could reach. They answered that Persians ate bread, and after describing what wheat was, said 80 years marked the furthest limit of a man's life. Hearing this, the Ethiopian remarked that he found it unsurprising men who fed on dung died after so few years. In fact, he added, they could not survive even that long were it not for the drink that revived them, and he pointed out the wine to the fish eaters. For by means of it this, he said, they themselves were surpassed by the Persians. When the fish eaters in turn asked the king about lifespan and diet, he said that most of them reached 120 years, and some even exceeded that. Their food was boiled meat, and their drink milk. When the spies expressed wonder at the number of years, he led them to a spring from which, when they bathed, they became more sleek, as if it were oil, and a scent like violets rose from it. The spies said the water of this spring was so weak that nothing at all could float on it, neither wood nor anything lighter than wood, but everything sank to the bottom. If this water is truly what report makes it out to be, that alone would explain why, relying on it for all their needs, they live so long. Leaving the spring behind, the visitors were led to a prison holding men, all of whom were shackled there in golden chains. Among these Ethiopians, bronze is the scarcest and most costly metal of all. Having taken in the prison as well, they went on to view the so-called Table of the Sun. Following that, last of all, they examined the coffins, said to be crafted from glass in this fashion. Once the body has been dried out, whether by the Egyptian method or some other means, it is coated entirely in gypsum and painted over, made to look as much like the living person as possible, and then a hollow pillar of glass, quarried there in great quantity and easily shaped, is set around it. Right at the center of the pillar, the body can be seen through the glass, giving off no foul odor and showing nothing else offensive, with every detail as clear as the body itself would be. For a full year, the closest relatives keep the pillar inside their home, presenting it with the first portion of everything and offering sacrifices before it. Afterward, they bring it out and set it up somewhere around the city. Having examined all this, the spies made their way back. When they reported it, Cambyses, in a fit of anger, immediately marched against the Ethiopians, without ordering any provision of food, and without considering that he was about to march to the ends of the earth. But being, as it were, mad and out of his senses, as soon as he heard the account of the fish eaters, he set out on campaign, ordering the Greeks who were with him to remain behind, while he brought the entire infantry force along with him. Once his march brought him to Thebes, he split off roughly 50,000 men from the army and instructed them to enslave the Ammonians and set fire to the Oracle of Zeus, while he himself pressed on with the remaining troops toward the Ethiopians. But before the army had traveled even a fifth of the distance, every scrap of food they carried had already run dry. And once the food ran out, the pack animals were eaten as well until none remained. Had Cambyses recognized this and turned the army back, he would still have counted as wise despite the mistake he made at the start. Instead, he gave the matter no thought whatsoever and pushed steadily onward. For as long as the men could find anything edible in the ground itself, they kept themselves alive on grass, but when they reached the sand, some of them did a terrible thing. Choosing one man in 10 by lot, they ate him. When Cambyses learned of this, fearing that they would turn to eating one another, he abandoned the expedition against the Ethiopians and turned back, reaching Thebes with the loss of a great part of his army. From Thebes, he went down to Memphis and let the Greeks sail away. Such was the outcome of the expedition against the Ethiopians. As for those who had been sent to make war on the Ammonians, when they set out from Thebes and marched on with their guides, they are known to have reached the city of Oasis, held by people said to be Samians of the Ishrionian tribe, 7 days' journey from Thebes through the sand. This place is called, in the Greek tongue, the Isle of the Blessed. The army is reported to have reached this spot. But concerning what happened afterward, only the Ammonians and those who heard the tale from them can say anything at all, since the soldiers never arrived among the Ammonians nor made their way back. The Ammonians themselves tell it this way. Once the men left this oasis and pushed on across the sand toward them, and had reached a point roughly halfway between the Ammonians and themselves, just as they sat down for their midday meal, a fierce and violent southern gale swept over them, piling up sand dunes that buried the men where they sat, and that was how they disappeared. Such is the Ammonian account of what became of this army. Once Cambyses reached Memphis, Apis appeared before the Egyptians, the god the Greeks know as Epaphus. When this appeared, the Egyptians at once put on their finest clothes and held festivities. Seeing the Egyptians doing this, Cambyses, quite convinced that they were holding this rejoicing because of his own misfortune, summoned the officials of Memphis. And when they came before him, he asked why the Egyptians had done nothing of the kind before, when he had previously been in Memphis, but did so now, when he himself was present, having lost a considerable part of his army. They explained that a god had appeared to them, one accustomed to appear only after a long interval, and that whenever he appeared, all the Egyptians rejoiced and held festival. Hearing this, Cambyses said they were lying, and as liars he punished them with death. Having killed these men, he next summoned the priests before him, and when they said the same things as their officials had, he declared that nothing would get past him if some docile god had truly come among the Egyptians. With that said, he ordered the priests to fetch Apis before him. Off they went to bring him. This creature, Apis or Epaphus, is born from a cow that afterward becomes unable to carry any further calf. According to the Egyptians, a beam of light falls onto the cow from the sky, and that from this she gives birth to Apis. This calf called Apis has the following markings. It is black, with a white triangle on its forehead, the likeness of an eagle on its back, doubled hairs on its tail, and a beetle under its tongue. When the priests brought Apis, Cambyses, being somewhat unhinged, drew his dagger and, meaning to strike Apis in the belly, struck him in the thigh instead. And laughing, he said to the priests, "You wretched fools, is this what gods become, creatures of blood and flesh, sensitive to iron? This is indeed a god worthy of the Egyptians, but you, at least, will not enjoy having made me a laughingstock over it." Having said this, he ordered those whose task it was to whip the priests and to kill any other Egyptians they found celebrating the festival. So the festival came to an end for the Egyptians, the priests were punished, and Apis, struck in the thigh, lay wasting away in the temple. And when he died of the wound, the priests buried him without Cambyses' knowledge. Cambyses, as the Egyptians say, immediately after committing that offense, he lost his mind, having never been entirely sound to begin with. The very first of his crimes was ridding himself of his own brother Smerdis, born of the same father and mother, whom he had already sent home to Persia out of jealousy, While both were still in Egypt, jealous, because Smerdis alone among the Persians had drawn the bow the fish eaters brought back from the Ethiopian, pulling it some 2 finger widths, a feat no other Persian could manage. Once Smerdis had departed for Persia, Cambyses had this dream while asleep. A messenger, it seemed, arrived from Persia announcing that Smerdis had taken his seat on the royal throne with his head brushing the sky. Alarmed for his own safety, fearing his brother might kill him and seize the throne, he dispatched Prexasps to Persia, the Persian he trusted above all others, to kill him. Prexasps went up to Susa and killed Smerdis, some say by leading him out on a hunt, others that he led him to the Red Sea and drowned him there. This, they say, was the first of the evils Cambyses began. The second thing he brought about was against his sister, who had followed him to Egypt, and with whom he lived as husband, and who was his sister by both parents. He had married her in this way, since up to that point the Persians had never once made a habit of marrying their own sisters. Cambyses grew infatuated with one of his sisters, and intending to marry her despite knowing this broke with tradition, he summoned the royal judges and asked them whether any law permitted a man to take his sister as wife. These royal judges are Persians selected for the post, serving until death or until some misconduct is discovered in them, and no further. Such men settle disputes among the Persians and serve as keepers of ancestral custom, with every matter brought before them for judgment. Faced with Cambyses' question, they gave a response both fair and safe. They could locate no statute permitting a brother to wed his sister, yet they had turned up a separate rule stating that the king of Persia may act however he pleases. In this way, they avoided breaking the law, out of fear of Cambyses, and, so that they themselves might not perish by upholding the law, they found another law alongside it, one that supported anyone wishing to marry his sisters. At that time, then, Cambyses married the woman he loved, but not long afterward he took another sister as well. It was the younger of these two whom he killed when she had followed him to Egypt. About her death, as about that of Smerdis, a double account is given. The Greeks say that Cambyses set a lion cub against a puppy, and that this wife of his was watching too, and when the puppy was losing, another puppy, its brother, broke its leash and came to help it, and the two puppies together got the better of the lion cub. Cambyses was delighted watching this, but the woman sitting by wept. When Cambyses noticed this, he asked why she was weeping, and she said that seeing the puppy come to its brother's aid had made her weep, remembering Smerdis and realizing that he had no one to avenge him. The Greeks say it was because of this remark that she was put to death by Cambyses. The Egyptians say that as they sat at table, the woman took a head of lettuce and stripped it bare, then asked her husband whether the lettuce looked better stripped bare or full-leaved, and he said full-leaved, and she said, "Yet you have made yourself like this lettuce, having stripped bare the house of Cyrus." At this, he flew into a rage and leapt upon her, though she was pregnant, and she miscarried and died. Such were the mad acts Cambyses committed against his own household, whether because of the Apis affair or for some other reason, as many misfortunes are apt to befall men. For indeed it is said that Cambyses had a great sickness from birth, which some call the sacred disease. It would not be strange, then, if with so great a sickness of body his mind too were not sound. Here is how his madness broke out against the rest of the Persians. It is said that he said to Prexasps, whom he honored most and who carried his messages, and whose son was Cambyses' cupbearer, an honor not small in itself. He is said to have spoken as follows. "Prexasps, what sort of man do the Persians think me, and what do they say about me?" And Prexasps said, "Master, in all else they praise you greatly, but they say you are given over too much to wine." So he reported what the Persians said, and Cambyses, furious, he answered in this manner. "So the Persians now claim that wine has driven me out of my senses, that I have lost my judgment. Then their earlier words to me must have been false as well." It seems that earlier, while the Persians sat in council together with Croesus, Cambyses had asked how they rated him next to his father Cyrus, and they replied that he surpassed his father, seeing that he retained everything his father once held, and had beyond that added Egypt along with mastery of the sea. Such was the Persians' verdict. Croesus, however, who stood there and found their judgment unsatisfying, said to Cambyses, To my eyes, son of Cyrus, you do not measure up to your father, since you have yet to produce a son to match the one he left in you. Cambyses took delight to hear this and praised Croesus's judgment. Remembering this now, he said angrily to Prexasps, "Now you learn whether the Persians speak the truth, or whether they themselves are out of their minds in saying this. If I shoot your son there standing in the porch and hit him right through the heart, it will be plain that the Persians say nothing true. But if I miss, then say that the Persians tell the truth, and that my mind has not left me." Having said this, he drew the bow and let the arrow fly at the boy. When the boy dropped, he ordered the body opened and the wound examined, and once the arrow was found lodged in the heart, he turned to the boy's father, laughing with evident satisfaction, and said, "Prexasps, this proves plainly enough that I am not mad, and that it is the Persians are out of their minds. Now tell me, have you ever seen anyone else among all men shoot so accurately?" And Prexasps, seeing that the man was out of his mind and fearing for himself, said, "Master, I do not think even the god himself could have shot so well." That was one thing he did. Another time he seized 12 Persians of the first rank, on no adequate charge whatsoever, and buried them alive head down. When he did this, Croesus the Lydian thought it right to admonish him with these words, "O king, do not surrender everything to youth and passion, but restrain and control yourself. It is good to look ahead, and forethought is wise. You are killing men who are your own countrymen on no adequate charge, and you are killing children too. If you do many such things, take care that the Persians do not revolt from you. Your father Cyrus charged me earnestly to advise and counsel you toward whatever good I could find." Thus he counseled him, showing goodwill, but Cambyses answered as follows, "You dare to counsel even me, you who governed your own country so well and gave such good counsel to my father, telling him to cross the river Araxes and march against the Massageti. When they were willing to cross into our land, you destroyed yourself by mismanaging your own country, and you destroyed Cyrus, who trusted you, though not to your own joy, since I have long wanted some pretext to lay hold of you." With these words, he took up his bow to shoot him, but Croesus sprang up and bolted outside. Unable to loose an arrow at him, Cambyses ordered his attendants to catch and kill him. His attendants, however, aware of his moods, hid Croesus away instead, reasoning as follows. Should Cambyses have a change of heart and wish for Croesus back, they would produce him and be rewarded for having spared his life. But should Cambyses feel no regret and show no longing for him, they would kill him then. Not long afterward, Cambyses did indeed long for Croesus, and the servants, learning of this, announced to him that Croesus was alive. Cambyses said he was glad Croesus survived, but that those who had preserved him would not go unpunished, he would put them to death, and he did so. Such were the many mad acts he committed against the Persians and their allies, while he remained in Memphis, opening ancient tombs and examining the corpses. So too he went into the temple of Hephaestus and mocked the image there a great deal. For the image of Hephaestus closely resembles the Phoenician patekoi, which the Phoenicians carry on the prows of their triremes. Anyone who has not seen these, I will describe them. It is the likeness of a pygmy man. He also went into the temple of the Cabiri, which it is forbidden for anyone to enter except the priest. These images too he burned, after mocking them a great deal. These images are also like those of Hephaestus, and the Cabiri are said to be his sons. In every way, then, it is clear to me that Cambyses was thoroughly mad. Otherwise, he would not have set about mocking sacred things and customs. For if one were to propose to all mankind that they choose out the best customs from all the customs there are, each people, after examining them, would choose its own. So strongly does each think its own customs by far the best. It is not likely, then, that anyone but a madman would make a mockery of such things. That all people hold this belief about their own customs can be established by many other evidences, and by this one in particular. Darius, in the course of his reign, summoned the Greeks who were present and asked for what price they would be willing to eat their dead fathers. They said they would not do that for any price. Darius then summoned some Indians called the Calatii, who eat their parents, and asked them, in the presence of the Greeks, who understood what was said through an interpreter, for what price they would agree to burn their dead fathers with fire. And they cried out loudly, bidding him say nothing so ill-omened. So firmly are such things established by custom, and Pindar seems to me right in calling custom king of all. While Cambyses was campaigning against Egypt, The Lacedaemonians also made an expedition against Samos and Polycrates, son of Eaxes, who rose to power and took control of Samos, splitting the city at first into three parts and granting shares to his brothers Pantagnatus and Silasen, only to later put one to death and banish the younger brother, Silasen, so that he alone controlled all of Samos. Once in full command, he struck up a friendly alliance with Amasis, king of Egypt, exchanging gifts with him in both directions. Before long, the power of Polycrates grew rapidly and became famous throughout Ionia and the rest of Greece. For wherever he turned to make war, everything went well for him. He had acquired 150-oared ships and 1,000 archers, and he plundered and carried off everyone's goods without distinction. For he said he would please a friend more by giving back what he had taken than by never having taken it at all. He had captured many of the islands and many cities on the mainland as well. And among others, when the Lesbians came out in full force to help the Milesians, he defeated them in a sea battle and took them captive, and it was they, bound in chains, who dug the whole ditch around the wall on Samos. Somehow Amasis did not fail to notice how greatly Polycrates was prospering, and it was a matter of concern to him. And when Polycrates' good fortune grew even greater still, Amasis wrote the following on a sheet and sent it to Samos. Amasis says this to Polycrates: "It is pleasant to learn that a friend and guest friend is doing well, but your great good fortune does not please me, since I know how jealous the divine is. I wish, both for myself and for those I care about, that in our affairs we should prosper in part and stumble in part, and so pass our lives alternating between the two rather than having good fortune in everything. For I have never yet heard tell of anyone who, having good fortune in everything, did not in the end come to a bad end and be utterly destroyed. So now, listen to me and do this in response to your good fortunes. Think of whatever you find to be most valuable to you, the thing whose loss would grieve your soul the most, and throw that away in such a way that it will never come again among men. And if from now on your good fortunes do not begin to alternate with misfortunes, then go on curing yourself in the manner I have prescribed." When Polycrates read this and took to heart how well Amasis was advising him, he searched for which of his treasures, if lost, would grieve his soul the most. And in searching, he found this. He had a signet ring that he wore, set in gold, made of emerald, the work of Theodorus, son of Telecles of Samos. Since he decided to throw this away, he did as follows. He manned a 50-oared ship with men and boarded it himself, then ordered it to be put out to sea. And when he was far from the island, he took off the ring, in full view of all his fellow sailors, and threw it into the sea. Having done this, he sailed back, and when he arrived at his house, he grieved over what had befallen him. Then, on the 5th or 6th day afterward, this is what happened to him. A fisherman, having caught a fish that was both large and handsome, judged it fit to present as a gift to Polycrates. So he brought it to the palace doors and said he wanted to be admitted into Polycrates' sight. And once he was let in, he spoke as he handed over the fish. "O king, when I took hold of this fish, I did not think it right to bring it to market, though I live by the work of my hands, but it seemed to me worthy of you and your rule, so I bring it to you and give it to you." Polycrates, pleased with these words, answered thus, "You have done very well, and I owe you double thanks, both for the words and for the gift, and I invite you to dinner." So the fisherman, thinking this a great honor, went back to his house. But as the servants were cutting the fish open, they discovered inside its stomach the very signet ring belonging to Polycrates. The moment they spotted it and picked it up, they hurried to Polycrates in great delight, and handing him the ring, they explained how it had turned up. It struck him that this was something divine at work, so he wrote down on a scroll every deed he had done and what had befallen him, and having written it, he sent it to Egypt. When Amasis read the letter that had come from Polycrates, he understood that it is impossible for one man to save another from what is destined to happen, and that Polycrates, prospering in everything, even finding again what he threw away, was not destined to end well. So he sent a herald to Samos and said he was dissolving the guest friendship. He did this for the following reason: so that when some terrible and great misfortune befell Polycrates, he himself would not have to grieve in his soul as over a guest friend. It was against this Polycrates, prospering in everything, that the Lacedaemonians made an expedition, called upon by those Samians who later founded Sidonia in Crete. Polycrates, sending a herald secretly, without the knowledge of the Samians, to Cambyses, son of Cyrus, who was gathering an army against Egypt, asked that Cambyses send to him and request troops from Samos as well. When Cambyses heard this, he sent eagerly to Samos, asking Polycrates to send a naval force along with him against Egypt. Polycrates picked out those of the citizens he most suspected of wanting to revolt and sent them off with 40 triremes, instructing Cambyses not to send them back. Some say that the Samians sent away by Polycrates never reached Egypt at all, but that when they got as far as Carpathus in their voyage, they took counsel among themselves, and it seemed good to them to sail no further. Others say that they did reach Egypt, and being kept under guard there, escaped from it. As they sailed back to Samos, Polycrates met them with ships and gave battle. The returning men won and landed on the island, but once they fought there on land they were beaten, and thus they sailed back toward Laestymon. Some claim instead that the Egyptian forces got the better of Polycrates, though to my mind that account is mistaken. There would have been no reason for them to summon the Spartans if they themselves had been capable of subduing Polycrates. Beyond that, it makes no sense that a man commanding so many paid soldiers and so great a number of native bowmen would be overcome by the returning Samian exiles, few as they were. Polycrates had rounded up the wives and children of the citizens under his rule and locked them inside the boat sheds, prepared, should those citizens go over to the returning exiles, to set fire to them together with the sheds. Once the Samians whom Polycrates had banished reached Sparta, they stood before the magistrates and spoke at great length, in the manner of men in great need would. The magistrates, at that first hearing, answered that they had forgotten what was said at the beginning and did not understand what was said at the end. Afterward, coming before them a second time, the Samians said nothing else, but brought a sack and said that the sack needed meal. The magistrates answered that the word sack was superfluous, but they decided to help them nonetheless. And so, after making their preparations, the Lacedaemonians made an expedition against Samos, as the Samians tell it, out of gratitude, because the Samians had once been the first to send them naval help against the Messenians. The Lacedaemonians, however, tell it differently, claiming they marched not so much to aid the pleading Samians as to punish them for stealing the mixing bowl meant for Croesus, along with the corslet that Amasis, king of Egypt, had sent them as a present. In fact, the Samians had seized the corslet a year before the bowl they took the bowl. It was made of linen, worked with many woven figures of animals, and adorned with gold and cotton fibers from wood. And what makes it worthy of wonder is that each single thread of the breastplate, though fine, contains within itself 360 threads, all of them visible. There is another one like it that Amasis dedicated at Lindus to Athena. The Corinthians, too, eagerly joined in contributing to the expedition against Samos, and the Corinthians joined in eagerly as well. For they, too, had been wronged by the Samians a generation earlier, an outrage that happened around the same time as the theft of the mixing bowl. Periander, son of Cypselus, had shipped 300 boys, sons of Corcyra's leading families, off to Sardis to Aliats to be made eunuchs. But when those escorting the boys put in at Samos the Samians, on hearing why the boys were bound for Sardis, first showed the boys how to cling to the temple of Artemis as suppliants. Afterward, refusing to let the Corinthians drag the suppliants from the sanctuary, and with the Corinthians trying to starve the boys into leaving, the Samians set up a festival that they still keep in the same fashion today. For once night fell, for however long the boys stayed as suppliants, they set up dances of maidens and young men, and in setting up these dances, they made it a custom to bring cakes of sesame and honey, so that the Corcyraean boys could snatch them and have food. This went on until the Corinthian guards of the boys gave up and went away, and the Samians led the boys away to Corcyra. Now if, after Periander's death, the Corinthians had kept friendly relations with the Corcyraeans and would not have taken part in the campaign against Samos for that reason. As things stand, though, ever since the island was settled, the two peoples have never gotten along, and it is for this that the Corinthians held their grudge against the Samians. Periander had sent off the sons of Corcyra's foremost men to Sardis to be made eunuchs as a means of getting even, for the Corcyraeans had been the first to begin against him, doing him a reckless wrong. For after Periander killed his own wife Melissa, another misfortune of the following kind happened to befall him in addition to the one already suffered. He had two sons by Melissa, one 17 and the other 18 years old. Their maternal grandfather Procles, who was tyrant of Epidaurus, sent for them and treated them kindly, as was natural, since they were sons of his own daughter. As he sent them off, he said to them in parting, "Boys, do you know the one responsible for your mother's death?" The older brother took this remark lightly, but the younger one, named Lycophron, was struck so hard by hearing it that once he reached Corinth he treated his father as his mother's killer and refused addressed him, and when the old man spoke to him he did not answer and gave no account of anything he asked. Finally Periander, out of temper with him, drove him out of the house. Having driven him out, he questioned the elder son as to what their grandfather had discussed with them. He told him how kindly he had received them, but of that saying which Procles had spoken as they were leaving, since he had not taken it to heart, he made no mention. Periander said there was no way that the old man had not given them some counsel, and he pressed him with questions. Then, recollecting, he told this too. Periander, taking note of this as well, and wishing to show no softness at all, sent word to those in whose house the son he had driven out was living, forbidding them to receive him in their homes. So whenever, being driven away, he came to another house, he was driven from that one too, since Periander threatened those who took him in and ordered them to shut him out. And being driven away, he would go to another of his companions, and they, since he was Periander's son, though afraid, nevertheless received him. At last, Periander made a proclamation that whoever took him into his house or spoke with him would owe a sacred fine to Apollo, of an amount as he had specified. Because of this proclamation, no one would speak with him or take him under their roof, and he himself judged it wrong to try what had been forbidden, so he stuck it out and lay about under the porticos. On the fourth day, when Periander saw him worn down from going unwashed and unfed, he felt pity for him. His anger easing, he stepped closer and said, "My boy, which of these two is preferable to go on doing what you're doing now, or to receive the tyranny and the good things I now have, which it is fitting for you, my son and heir of prosperous Corinth, to take up, you who have chosen a wandering life, resisting and giving way to anger against the one man you least ought to? For if some misfortune has occurred among us, from which you now suspect me of, that same thing befell me too, and I bear a greater share of the blame in it, since I myself brought it to pass. But you, once you understand how much better it is to be envied than pitied, and what it means to rage against one's parents and one's betters alike, should go back home." With such words, Periander tried to bring him around, but the son gave no other answer to his father, except to say that he owed the god a sacred fine for having come into conversation with him. Periander, realizing that his son's affliction was hopeless and beyond remedy, sent him away out of his sight, fitting out a ship to Corcyra, for he ruled over that place as well. Having sent him off, Periander made war on his father-in-law Procles, as being chiefly to blame for this, and he seized Epidaurus and captured Procles himself alive. But as time passed, Periander grew old and came to realize he could no longer watch over and run affairs himself, so he sent word to Corcyra recalling Lycophron to take the tyranny. For in his older son he saw no promise at all, but he appeared to him rather dull-witted. Lycophron did not even think the messenger worth an answer. Periander, clinging to the young man, sent a second envoy after him, his own daughter, the young man's sister, thinking that he would surely be persuaded by her most of all. When she arrived and said, "My son, do you want the tyranny to fall to others and our father's house to be torn apart rather than to go and possess it yourself? Come home, stop punishing yourself. Pride is a poor possession. Do not cure one evil with another. Many prefer the more reasonable course to the strictly just one, and many, in seeking their mother's inheritance, have lost their father's. Tyranny is a precarious thing, and it has many lovers, and our father is already old and past his prime. Do not give away your own good fortune to any other than these." She, coached by her father in the most persuasive words, repeated them to him, but he replied that he would never set foot in Corinth so long as he learned his father was still living. Once she reported this back, Periander sent a herald a third time, intending to go to Corcyra himself, while bidding Lycophron come to Corinth and take over the tyranny in his place. When the son agreed to these terms, Periander set out for Corcyra, and his son for Corinth. But when the Corcyraeans learned all this, in order that Periander should not come to their land, they killed the young man. In revenge for this, Periander took vengeance upon the Corcyraeans. The Lacedaemonians, when they arrived with a great fleet, laid siege to Samos. Attacking the wall at the tower standing near the sea by the suburb of the city, they mounted it. But then, when Polycrates came to its defense with a large force, they were driven back. At the upper tower on the ridge of the mountain, both the mercenaries and a good number of the Samians themselves came out against them. They received the Lacedaemonians and for a short time fled back, and the Lacedaemonians, pursuing, killed them. Now, if the Lacedaemonians present had matched Archias and Lycopas that day, Samos would have fallen. For Archias and Lycopas, the only two who charged in among the fleeing Samians toward the wall, got cut off from retreat and died there inside the Samian city. In the third generation after this Archias, I myself came to know another man named Archias, son of Samius, son of that Archias, at Pittin, for that was his deme. And he honored the Samians more than any other guest friends, and told me that his father had been named Samius because his father Archias had died fighting bravely at Samos. And he said he honored the Samians because his grandfather had been buried at public expense by the Samians. The Lacedaemonians, when 40 days had passed while they were besieging Samos and their affairs made no further progress, withdrew to the Peloponnese. As the more fanciful account has it, it is said that Polycrates struck local coinage, gilding over a great deal of lead, and gave it to them, and that they, having accepted it, departed on that account. This was the first expedition into Asia made by the Dorian Lacedaemonians. Those Samians who had campaigned against Polycrates, when the Lacedaemonians were about to abandon them, themselves also sailed away, to Siphnos, since they were in need of money, and the affairs of the Siphnians were at their height at that time. And they were the wealthiest of the islanders, since they had gold and silver mines on their island, so much so that from a tenth of the revenue produced there a treasury was dedicated at Delphi to match the wealthiest ones. And they themselves distributed among themselves the money produced each year. Now when they were building the treasury, they consulted the oracle whether their current good fortune was destined to last a long while, and the Pythia gave them this answer. But whenever the council hall in Siphnos turns white, along with the white-browed marketplace, then a shrewd man is needed to watch out for a wooden ambush and a red herald. At that time, the marketplace and council hall of the Siphnians were in fact faced with Parian marble. This prophecy they were unable to grasp, neither right away nor once the Samians had actually arrived. For as soon as the Samians touched at Siphnos, they sent one of their ships bearing envoys into the city. In earlier days, every ship was coated in red ochre, and this was exactly what the Pythia had warned the Siphnians of, telling them to guard against the wooden ambush and a red herald. So the envoys, on arrival, requested that the Siphnians lend them 10 talents, and when the Siphnians declined, the Samians set about pillaging their territory. Hearing of this, the Siphnians rushed out at once to defend themselves, and after joining battle with them, they were routed, with many of them shut out of the city by the Samians, who afterwards squeezed 100 talents out of them. From the Hermionians, in exchange for money, they took the island of Hydria off the Peloponnese and deposited it in trust with the Troezenians, and they themselves founded Sidonia in Crete, though they were not sailing there for that purpose, but to drive the Zacynthians from the island. They remained there and prospered for 5 years, so that the temples now standing in Sidonia are the work of these men, as is the temple of Dictina. But in the 6th year the Aeginetans, together with the Cretans, defeated them in a sea battle and enslaved them, and cut off the boars' heads from the prows of their ships and dedicated them in the temple of Athena in Aegina. This the Aeginetans did out of a grudge against the Samians, for earlier the Samians, in the reign of Amphicrates over Samos, had campaigned against Aegina and had done the Aeginetans great harm, and had suffered likewise at their hands. This was the reason for it. I have dwelt at greater length on the Samians because they have accomplished 3 of the greatest works of all the Greeks, a mountain 150 fathoms high, with a tunnel dug beneath it, open at both ends. The length of this tunnel is 7 stadia, and its height and width are each 8 feet. Throughout its whole length another channel has been dug, 20 cubits deep and 3 feet in width, through which water flows by way of pipes and reaches the city, drawn from a great spring. The engineer behind this tunnel was Eupolinus of Megara, son of Nostrophus. That is one of the three great works. The second is a breakwater around the harbor, set in the sea to a depth of 20 fathoms, running more than 2 stadia in length. The third piece of work they have completed is the biggest temple of any we know of. Its earliest builder was Rochus, son of Phils, a local man. For these reasons, I have spent somewhat more space discussing the Samians. Now, while Cambyses, son of Cyrus, was delayed in Egypt and had lost his sanity, 2 Magian brothers revolted against him. Cambyses had left one of them behind to look after his household. It was this man who rose against him once he learned of Smerdes's death, how he came to be hidden, and how few of the Persians knew of him, while most believed him still alive. Having considered this, he set about the following scheme against the royal house. He had a brother, whom I have said rose up with him, who resembled in appearance Smerdes the son of Cyrus, the very man whom Cambyses had put to death, though he was his own brother. This man was like Smerdes not only in appearance, but carried the same name, Smerdes. The Magus Patizides convinced this man that he himself would handle everything, then installed him upon the royal throne. Having done this, he dispatched heralds far and wide, including to Egypt, to announce to the army that from then on they owed obedience to Smerdes, son of Cyrus, not Cambyses. The rest of the heralds made the same announcement, and so did the one assigned to Egypt. Finding Cambyses and his army in Syria at Ecbatana, he stood before them and delivered the message ordered by the Magus. Cambyses, hearing this from the herald and believing it true, and thinking himself betrayed by Prexasps, since he had sent that man to kill Smerdes and Prexasps had not carried it out, looked at Prexasps and said, "Prexasps, is this how you carried out the task I entrusted to you?" And he said, "Master, this is not true, that Smerdes your brother has risen against you, nor that any quarrel, great or small, will come to you from that man. For I myself, doing what you commanded me, buried him with my own hands, of my own doing. If the dead can indeed rise, then you may as well expect Astyages the Mede to rise up against you too. But if matters stand as before, nothing newer will ever spring from that quarter against you. So it seems best to me now that we chase down the herald and press him, asking on whose authority he came here proclaiming that we must obey King Smerdes." This satisfied Cambyses, and the herald was chased down and brought back at once. The herald arrived, and once he had come, Prexasps put this question to him, "Fellow, you claim to have come as messenger from Smerdes, son of Cyrus. Tell me the truth now, and you may go free afterward. Did Smerdes himself appear before you and give these orders in person, or was it one of his attendants?" He answered, "I have laid eyes on no Smerdes, son of Cyrus, since King Cambyses set out for Egypt. It was the Magus whom Cambyses put in charge of his household who gave me these orders, claiming that Smerdes, son of Cyrus, was the one instructing me to tell you this." He told them the plain truth without any deceit, and Cambyses replied, "Prexasps, since you acted as a loyal man ought and carried out what was asked of you, you are cleared of blame. But which Persian could this be who has revolted and seized the name of Smerdes?" And he said, "I think I understand, O king, what has happened. The Magi are the ones who have risen against you, the one you left as caretaker of your household, Patizides, and his brother Smerdes." Then, when Cambyses heard the name of Smerdes, the truth of the word struck him, and of the dream too, in which it had seemed to him that someone reported to him that Smerdes, sitting upon the royal throne, touched the sky with his head. Realizing then that he had killed his brother for nothing, he wept for Smerdes. And having wept and being greatly distressed at the whole misfortune, he leapt onto his horse, intending to march to Susa as quickly as possible against the Magus. And as he leapt onto his horse, the cap of his sword scabbard fell off, and the sword, being bared, struck his thigh. Wounded in that same spot where he himself had once struck the Egyptian's god Apis, and since it seemed to him that the blow had struck a vital spot, Cambyses asked what the name of the city was, and they said, "Ecbatana." But even before this, it had been prophesied to him from the city of Buto that he would end his life at Ecbatana. He had supposed that he would die an old man at the Median Ecbatana, where all his affairs lay. But the oracle, it turned out, had meant the Ecbatana in Syria. And now, when he inquired and learned the name of the town, struck by the disaster of the Magus, and by his wound he came to his senses, and grasping the meaning of the prophecy, he said, "It is fated that Cambyses, son of Cyrus, will meet his end right here.